Hi, and welcome to the magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Bill Walton. Today, I will be reading from the March 2024 issue of The Atlantic. We'll start today's program finishing the article from last week titled In Defense of Woodrow Wilson by David Frum. In Wilson's address to Congress on April 2, 1917, he insisted that the world must be made safe for democracy. Modern-day Americans commonly interpret those words as a vow to convert the whole world to democracy. What Wilson meant, however, was that the nation could no longer hope to find security in the detached and distant situation of its geographic location. The United States had grown too big. Distances of time and space had narrowed too much for it to be unaffected by the actions of once remote countries. Recoiling from Wilson's vision of mutual international benefit, many of his present-day critics yearn for a foreign policy that relies on dominating a small number of client states and ignoring the rest of the world from behind border walls and trade protections. People who take this view call themselves America First, perhaps unaware that Wilson himself seized the phrase as a campaign slogan in 1916. Now, in the 21st century, we see the strange sight of political partisans using Wilson's own America First phrase to attack Wilson's highest ideals. In February 2023, one of the harshest critics of U.S. support for democratic Ukraine spoke at the Heritage Foundation. At the core of Senator Josh Hawley's remarks was an attack on Wilson. Woodrow Wilson, as you may remember, was a dedicated internationalist. He was a dedicated globalist on principle, by the way. I mean, he thought that we should make the world safe for democracy. That was his line that he famously used. And I think what you saw is after the Cold War, you had a whole generation of American policymakers who said the Wilsonian moment has now arrived. Borders don't matter. American uniqueness doesn't matter. We're going to make all of the world more like America, and we're going to make America more like the world. And there'll be this great global integration. Wilson believed almost none of those things. What Wilson did believe was that American security had become inseparable from the security of others, and that American power would be accepted only if guided by universal values. Wilson argued this case most explicitly in a January 1918 address to Congress. The speech is famous for the 14 points he enumerated, a U.S. war aims. But more important than any specific aim was the logic undergirding them all. What we demand in this war, therefore, is nothing peculiar to ourselves. It is that the world be made fit and safe to live in, and particularly that it be made safe for every peace-loving nation which, like our own, wishes to live its own life, determine its own institutions, be assured of justice and fair dealing by the other peoples of the world as against force and selfish aggression. All the peoples of the world are in effect partners in this interest, and for our own part, we see very clearly that unless justice be done to others, it will not be done to us. Wilson was the first world leader to perceive security as a benefit that could be shared by like-minded nations. Until then, each great power had clambered over others to field bigger armies, float bigger navies, and accumulate more colonies. This competition had culminated in the disastrous outbreak of the Great War. Wilson glimpsed the possibility of a different way, that shared values might provide a more stable basis for peace among advanced nations than the quest for military dominance. Only the U.S. possessed the wealth and power to make the vision work. Tragically, neither the U.S. nor the world was ready for this vision in Wilson's lifetime. The president himself lacked the skill, expertise, and tact to realize it. But the vision lay dormant, waiting for a future chance. I am not personally a thorough admirer of Wilson's. A famous quip attributed to Winston Churchill about another political moralist might have applied to Wilson's austere personality. He has all the virtues I dislike and none of the vices I admire. An evening with Theodore Roosevelt would have been fun, but most of us would have wished to bid an early good night to Wilson, especially once he'd revealed that his favorite form of humor was mildly smutty limericks. Wilson's bigotry was as chilly as his wit. He started his teaching career at Bryn Mawr. One of his associates there, the daughter of an abolitionist minister, remarked to an early biographer that Wilson was the first Southern white man she'd ever met with no personal warmth for any individual black person. Wilson's tariff, banking, and regulatory reforms were driven more by a quest for rationality and efficiency than by empathy and compassion. The British liberal governments that held power from 1905 to the outbreak of World War I introduced that country's first old age pensions and unemployment insurance. In the United States, broad programs of social insurance would have to await the New Deal of the 1930s. As a war leader, Wilson deferred absolutely to professional soldiers' advice, even though those soldiers had learned their trade in small wars against weak enemies. The approach cost many American lives when the top U.S. military commander, John Pershing, rebuffed British and French efforts to teach American troops the painful lessons they had learned from prior years of Western Front experience. Americans went into battle in 1918 still using the human wave tactics that had cost the British and French so dearly. Wilson's gravest failures were in his chosen mission as a peacemaker. As the former U.S. diplomat Philip Zelikow details in his damning book, The Road Less Traveled, Wilson personally bungled a real opportunity to reach peace in the second half of 1916. All of the principal combatants yearned for such a peace, but none dared to be the first to ask for it. All were looking for the U.S. to lead, as it had led the peace negotiations after the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 05. Wilson fatally hesitated to apply such leadership, nor did he delegate the task to anyone who might have succeeded. When the war instead ended with the German collapse in 1918, Wilson never grasped or even paid much attention to the problems of post-war economic recovery, domestic or international. He was a man of ideas and ideals, not one of ledgers and accounts, of words, not numbers. The United States plunged into a severe economic depression in 1920. War-scarred and hungry Europe suffered even more. Voters emphatically rejected Wilson's party in the 1920 elections. The Republican congressional majorities of the 1920s returned to the high tariff policies of the 19th century, dooming any hope that Germany, Britain, France, Belgium, Italy, and other former combatants might export their way to economic normality. Instead, the United States insisted on collecting war debts from former allies. To repay the U.S., the former allies were left no choice but to squeeze Germany for reparations. To finance reparations, Germany massively borrowed from U.S. private sector lenders. The cycle of tariff-driven debt helped set in motion the catastrophe of the Great Depression. The post-Wilson Democrats bitterly split along regional and cultural lines. It took them 103 ballots to nominate a presidential candidate at their convention in New York City in 1924. The Republicans would win that year's election decisively, and 1928's too, by running against Wilson's war and the depression that followed. Only after another war, even more terrible than the one that came before it, was Wilson's foreign policy legacy at last rehabilitated. As Americans and their allies developed institutions of collective security, free trade, and global governance after 1945, Wilson's best ideals were realized at last. This is the Wilson who remains to this day the founder and definer of American world leadership. Henry Kissinger, who despised Wilson and, I suspect, inwardly hoped to displace his intellectual primacy, ultimately had to admit in his 1994 book, Diplomacy. It is above all to the drumbeat of Wilsonian idealism that American foreign policy has marched since his watershed presidency and continues to march to this day. I very much believe that the United States has been a force for good in the world in the 20th and 21st centuries. If you do also, then our appreciation must begin with the foundational achievements of the president who first exerted that force. You do not need to withhold any single criticism of Woodrow Wilson, the man and the president, to regret the harm done by the unbalanced and totalizing censure that has been heaped upon him over the past decade. Wilson was a great domestic reformer. He was the first American president to perceive and explain how American power could anchor the peace of a future democratic world. His ideas and ideals still undergird American foreign policy as its most generous and successful. His words still reverberate more than a century later, long after those of his contemporary critics have lapsed into obscurity. When the United States rallies to the defense of Ukraine against Russian invasion or of Guyana against Venezuelan threats, when it seeks peace through free trade agreements and joins with allies to deter aggression, it is speaking in the language originally chosen by Woodrow Wilson. So how should we comprehend the people of bygone times when their principles and prejudices diverge from those that now prevail? In a speech delivered in 1896, Wilson declared, "Nothing is easier than to falsify the past. Lifeless instruction will do it. If you rob it of vitality, stiffen it with pedantry, sophisticate it with arguments, chill it with unsympathetic comment, you render it as dead as any academic exercise. Your real and proper object, after all, is not to expound, but to realize it. Consort with it, and make your spirit kin with it, so that you may never shake the sense of obligation off." Modern America owes just such an obligation to Wilson. He showed the way to the modern world. He did not reach his hoped-for destination, but neither yet have we. Cancel Wilson, and you empower those who seek to discredit the high goals for which he worked. Those are goals still worth working for. To realize them, supporters of American global leadership cannot dispense with the practical and moral legacy of Woodrow Wilson. Acknowledge his flaws and failures, then restore Wilson's name to the places of honor from which it was hastily and wrongly purged. Now, that article titled In Defense of Woodrow Wilson was written by David Frum, who is a staff writer at The Atlantic. This next article is written by James Parker, and is titled The James Bond Trap. Ian Fleming created the super spy and then couldn't get rid of him. The next Bond movie should be called Libido of Secrecy. It should be called Marmalizer, Mercury Face, Die to Tell the Tale. Actually, and I'm quite serious, it should be called The Black Daffodil, after Ian Fleming's only book of poetry. Nicholas Shakespeare, in his walloping new biography, Ian Fleming, The Complete Man, describes this slim volume, bound in black and self-published in 1928, as the Holy Grail for Fleming collectors. He was 20. He was arty. Shakespeare includes a contemporary sample from Fleming's journal. If the wages of sin are death, I am willing to pay. I have had my short spasm of life. Now let death take its sway. We have to rely on the sample because the Black Daffodil itself is gone. He read me several poems. Fleming's friend and sometime business partner, Ivar Bryce, remembered, the beauty of which moved me deeply. But then something went wrong, or some other presence moved in. He took every copy that had been printed, Bryce continued, and consigned the whole edition pitilessly to the flames. Rather Bond-like, that pitilessly. Bond-like, too, is a short spasm of life in the little poem. In fact, although he wouldn't be born for another 24 years, if you squint at the Black Daffodil episode, at this tiny debacle in the artistic life of Ian Fleming, you can indeed make out the wriggling germ of James Bond. Fleming worried that his youthful verses aped Rupert Brooke, the golden young man who wrote The Soldier in 1914 and who probably would have been killed at Gallipoli had he not been carried off en route by an infected mosquito bite. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. And isn't there a corner of James Bond that vibrates forever with this perfumed Georgian strain of romantic English fatalism and mystical chauvinism? Although rooted now through the circuits of a sleek 20th century killing machine, a killing and shagging machine who likes scrambled eggs for breakfast and smokes fancy pants blended cigarettes. Maybe we can put it like this. Ian Fleming wrote the poetry, and James Bond, that bastard, that Black Daffodil, burned it. As he sprang from his author's head in the early months of 1952, with a .25 Beretta in his left armpit, Bond was in many ways a product of psychic necessity. Fleming, in his mid-40s, and against everybody's advice, was about to get married. His bride, Anne Charteris, was aristocratic and reckless. "We are, of course, totally unsuited," Fleming wrote to his new brother-in-law. "I am a non-communicator, a symmetrist, of a bilious and melancholic temperament. Anne is a sanguine anarchist, traditionalist. So China will fly, and there will be rage and tears." On the morning of the wedding, which was held down the road from Fleming's Golden Eye Estate in Jamaica, the happy couple were jarred awake by the croaking of an unknown bird. Doom. He had already finished the first draft of Casino Royale. He was quite an interesting man, Ian Fleming. Born into great wealth and great expectations, he sequentially disgraced himself at Eton, General Lauchness, and Sandhurst, gonorrhea, clanging about in the shadow of his older brother, Peter, an acclaimed author-adventurer. His father had been killed in the First World War. His mother was a nightmare. redeemed by a spell at a private educational establishment in the Austrian Alps, where he was introduced to the work of the psychologist Alfred Adler. He took the Adlerian concept of the inferiority complex very much to heart. He returned strengthened to the world. The Foreign Office didn't want him, but journalism did. Shakespeare's account of the Stalinist show trial of six British engineers, which Fleming covered in Moscow in 1933 for Reuters, is riveting. And he had an interesting war. The weird thing about the Bond books, it may be their secret, is that they read like the work of a gifted and faintly sociopathic researcher, somebody with no actual experience of espionage, geopolitics, money, travel, fighting, or indeed humans. In fact, Fleming was worldly to a degree and, if anything, overqualified to write spy novels. From the late 1930s to 1945, he worked at the top levels of naval intelligence, liaising between the Admiralty and Downing Street, and was closely involved with, among other things, operational planning and target selection for two elite intelligence gathering units, 30 AU and T-Force. These were his glory days. Shakespeare used the journalist Alan Moorhead's line about soldiers at war to describe Fleming. He was, for a moment in time, a complete man, and he had this sublimity in him. But now it was the 50s, and that was all over. The empire was suffering post-war contractions, and Fleming was no longer running his quasi-private armies. And at GoldenEye, he faced the shutdown of decades of swinging bachelordom. "I was in a terrible state," he explained to his confidant, Maud Russell, "and appalled at the thought of getting married. I sat down at the typewriter." Casino Royale is an odd book, oddly written, oddly paced, and suffused with an obsessive, almost sickly sensuality. He watched carefully as the deep glass became frosted with the pale golden drink, slightly aerated by the bruising of the shaker. The action is mostly bungled, until the famous torture scene, when Bond gets his underpart flogged with a carpet beater, and the prose snaps into rapturous focus. Bond's flesh cringed as the cane surface just touched him. Fleming and Anne liked whipping each other. And Bond is an odd character, an odd and very modern hero, an automaton and a sybarite. He is mentally efficient, almost clinically so, with an emptiness of head that anticipates Jack Reacher. He closed his eyes and his thoughts pursued his imagination through a series of carefully constructed scenes as if he was watching the tumbling chips of colored glass in a kaleidoscope. But he's also extremely fussy, American Psycho style, about drinks, cars, what to wear to bed. Bond had always disliked pajamas and had slept naked until in Hong Kong, at the end of the war, he came across the perfect compromise. This was a pajama coat, which came almost down to the knees. The point is that all the elements, the nastiness, the daintiness, the vacancy, the improbability, and the creepy voluptuousness were present from the beginning, and it wouldn't take long for Fleming to perfect the mixture. 1957's From Russia with Love, for example, is an excellent read. The writing mostly got done at GoldenEye, at high speed, sometimes on a gold-plated typewriter. From Jamaica, he would send his manuscripts to his friend, Claire Blanchard, in New York. Blanchard, a devout Catholic, was always appalled, The only explanation I have, she says in Ian Fleming, is that he wrote the books uninhibitedly and that the forces of evil came through them as water comes through a tap. Fame as the creator of James Bond, in combination with his old elite connections, would project Fleming back into the center of events. Senator John F. Kennedy, a huge fan, sought his counsel about Cuba. Massive success was Fleming's at last. But the Black Daffodil was upon him. By 1960, he was sick of Bond and wondering how he could kill him off. "How the keys creak as I type," he complained in a letter to the novelist William Plomer. Bond, however, was as impervious to death as was Dracula, Shakespeare writes. The last chapters of Ian Fleming are dark. Bond, taking over the world as his creator, staggers through heart attacks toward a premature death. Fleming succumbed at age 56. The short spasm, shortened further by 70 cigarettes a day and lashings of booze, was over. The journalist, Malcolm Muggeridge, writing in 1966 to Fleming's first biographer, John Pearson, had a warning. "Don't you get destroyed by Bond's ghost, as Ian did by his creation. Remember, he's the devil." And that article, titled "The James Bond Trap," was written by James Parker, who was a staff writer at The Atlantic. And that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the March 2024 issue of The Atlantic. I'm Bill Walton. So long. Until next time.